Today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 90-year-old World War II veteran who flew 70 missions in a B-25 bomber. We'll hear how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross and what it felt like to face the gauntlet of German anti-aircraft fire.
You can hear the shrapnel bite through the metal skin of the aircraft. You just hope it didn't have your name on it.
How about the name on the side of his B-25? I think you might get a chuckle out of that, too. Today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. You can hear us on News Talk 580 or FM 105.9 every Saturday at 1 o'clock. Each week we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is to make sure they know how much we appreciate their service and sacrifice, also to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and along the way be educated and inspired by members of our greatest generation. The man we're going to meet today is the recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross. He retired as a lieutenant colonel in 1982, after many years in the Air Force Reserve. He first ended up in the U.S. Army Air Corps way back in 1943. But we're going to go back earlier than that with 90-year-old Dick Emler of Fresno. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Where were you, and how did you find out that Japan had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Oh, I was in San Jose, California, and probably heard it on the radio. But I was riding my motorcycle, and we went from San Jose to Santa Cruz for the day, and that's about it.
And you survived on the 17? That's a windy road.
Oh, it wasn't too bad. Part of it was rebuilt by then. It was good. It was good road.
Good road for a motorcycle. When you heard that news about Pearl Harbor, how did that register with you? Did you have a clue that the world was changing and your life might change?
Didn't have the foggiest notion.
How soon did you figure that out?
It took a while, a couple of weeks, I guess. I guess the big impact was the morning of the 8th of December at a high school assembly, when the superintendent addressed us and told us, and we heard the broadcast from President Roosevelt in his day of infamy.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
So you're a senior in high school, and you go back to school, and this is what you're greeted with.
Yeah, that's right.
And what was that like in that assembly when the president finished talking? Was it a somber mood in there? Did you find guys motivated to go do something about it? How do you remember that?
Oh, it was real quiet. I don't really recall too much about it. It's too far back. Too many years have come through.
Yeah, and you flew too many missions that are more in the forefront of your mind. Had you thought about being a pilot before the war?
No, I didn't. I thought about joining the Navy, but the Navy didn't want me, and the Army did, and I met a fellow at the Presidio Monterey who I rode motorcycles with, and he said he was going to be a pilot, and I said, well, if you can be one, I can be one, and that's the way we went. We both wound up as pilots. He wound up as a fighter pilot, and I wound up in a B-25.
And not too many people can tell that story of flying B-25s, but when you were drafted and when you got that idea of being a pilot, did you want to be a fighter pilot too?
I had some inclination in that line, but I guess the Air Force had different ideas for me. That's all right. I'm not complaining.
What was the toughest part? Because so many guys who dreamed of being pilots washed out before they ever got that chance, or they came oh so close but ended up being a navigator or a bombardier, an engineer. What was the toughest part for you of the whole process of training to become a pilot? What was the most challenging?
Oh, the math class in pre-flight, because I was not really too sharp on mathematics at that time. I did some extra work, but I made it.
You said the most challenging was this math class, and your daughter tells me that you had a unique way of studying to keep up there. Where did you hide out to do after-hours book work?
Well, that was in the pre-flight at Maxwell Field in Montgomery, Alabama. And after lights out and a bed check, then I'd take my books and sneak down to the latrine, get in the shower stall, and pull my feet up underneath me so nobody could find me, and study by the light of the in the room. And that was about it.
So without that effort, that extra effort, you probably never would have gotten your wings, huh?
Probably not.
Well, it's a good thing, and I understand that's your personality. When you commit to something, you follow through. The B-25, I think most people, if they know anything about a B-25, the first thing they think of is the Doolittle raid on Tokyo from the USS Hornet. Did you hear about that when it happened?
No, not that I recall, because that was 42, and I don't really remember that part of it.
Having flown 70 missions in a B-25, can you imagine taking off from an aircraft carrier in one of those bombers that you flew?
Oh, absolutely I can. It was a hard way to go.
Did you have to do that? Go off the deck of an aircraft carrier?
No, I didn't. I was always land-based.
Good thing. That was quite the odds-defying thing they did there. So the first time you flew a B-25, what was your impression? What did that feel like?
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. I didn't want to do anything else.
Did you, I'm sure you knew pilots who were flying other bombers. I'm sure there are B-24 guys around, B-17 guys every once in a while. Did you have a little rivalry going with those guys? Did you think your plane was better? And if so, why?
Oh, all the pilots thought their aircraft was better than the rest of the other guy. So we're all about the same way of thinking. Our airplane was the best.
What about the B-25 did you appreciate so much?
Very sturdy, well-built aircraft. It would take care of its crew. No matter how hard it was hit, sometime even losing part of the tail assembly, the aircraft would make it back to the base.
Well, and I know you have some of those stories to tell. In fact, you even kept a piece of shrapnel that almost took your life. Unfortunately, that shrapnel and some of your medals were stolen, and we're going to see what we can do about that. Hopefully, law enforcement is helping out already, and we'll get your congressman involved if we can to get those medals back for you. But let's talk about your early missions. Now, you went overseas. You got to Corsica in 1944. What did you find when you got there? What was the lay of the land, as they say?
It was a very mountainous island, and fortunately we were on a flat area next to the coast. That was in August of 1944.
This is the 321st Bomb Group, the 445th Squadron, guys who had been bombing Italy a lot up to that point. But when you got there, what were the targets that you guys were focused on?
Well, we were still after railroad bridges and transportation bridges and railroad yards and ammunition dumps. Anything that we saw could hinder the war effort of the Germans, that's what we were after.
And were you in a situation where the crew that you actually got to fly with was made up of guys that you had trained with, or were these new people to you?
My crew was all new people. They transferred down from the 8th Air Force and stayed with me from the time they got there till the very end in May of 1945.
So once you got them, they stuck with you. That must have given you some sense of comfort.
Well, yes, but when they first got together, I told them that I would do my best to take care of them as long as they took care of me. And if they didn't like the way I flew or for some reason wanted to go to another crew, I'd try and accommodate them.
And you mentioned they came from the 8th Air Force. Your group, of course, was part of the 12th Air Force. For people who maybe aren't so familiar with a B-25, give us a sense of how many guys are on that crew and what you had to depend on them for.
Well, generally there were only six. The lead aircraft had seven because they had a navigator. But there was a navigator on the lead aircraft, was a navigator, the bombardier, pilot, co-pilot, engineer, and radio man and tail gunner.
So on your aircraft, six men, how responsible did you feel for those other five lives aboard your bomber?
I was quite responsible. We were all. It was kind of a mutual pact that we were all responsible for each other.
Now we're going to get to the mission that earned you a Distinguished Flying Cross, and I'll read for everyone that citation. I want to hear about some of your close calls. You say you remember all of your missions. I want to know what you remember about your first mission. Did you have some butterflies? Were you anxious about what was going to lay in front of you?
Oh, I really didn't know what was going to happen, but I soon found out. I don't remember where we went on that particular mission. I was a co-pilot for one of the seasoned veterans, and I probably first saw the black flashes of the anti-aircraft weapons, but I really didn't have any idea of what we were into.
What was the moment where you realized, wow, I really didn't know what I was getting into, and this is pretty awful?
Well, I guess probably the second or third mission when they were still shooting at us. I didn't have too many easy missions. Most of them were pretty heavily defended by the Germans.
What can you tell us about the Brenner Pass and the significance of that? I mean, I understand you're pretty well versed in the statistics of what was happening there. What can you tell me about the Brenner Pass between Italy and Austria?
Well, that was a main supply line from Europe proper in Germany down to the troops in Italy. And without that, we pretty well starved them out. We pretty well saturated from November of 44 through March of 45. We pretty well shut them down. We had their Brenner Pass totally closed off for over 3 months, especially in the wintertime, which is tough on everybody. In the, I think I mentioned it, in the 10-mile, they had over 1,000 anti-aircraft weapons, 88-millimeter, 105-millimeter, and that's pretty devastating. We lost a lot of aircraft in that short period. And out of my 70 missions, 40% of mine were in that Brenner Pass. Again, I'm entirely, totally grateful that I survived.
Well, and you saw very clearly what was possible and how some others didn't survive. How many airplanes did you see shot down right next to you?
Oh, a total of three. Two of them in the Po Valley and one in the Brenner Pass. Oh, two of them were in October. The lead aircraft flown by Lieutenant Russell and his bombardier, Danny Galindo, and the one on the number three position, far left wing, was Lieutenant Frank and Lieutenant Reed. And in that aircraft, there were no survivors at all. But in the lead aircraft, Russell and Galindo, I know, did recover. And I understand that Danny Galindo later became a detective for Los Angeles Police Department and played a role in the Charles Manson case.
Good thing he survived. Being on that B-25, did you have a sense of what part of that aircraft was maybe more safe than others? Were there some vulnerable parts of that aircraft that made you a little nervous?
No, to my knowledge, it was all vulnerable 100% because if he got hit in the right place, down it went, and that's about it.
So you know, day in, day out, that you're going back there. And you also know that they're going to be waiting for you again because you've seen that anti-aircraft fire. How did you deal with that constant threat of flak that you knew you were going to have to fly straight through?
You just do what you have to do. That's all I can say about it.
Now, I mentioned the piece of shrapnel that you did hold on to that some heartless thief stole from you. What's the story behind that piece of shrapnel? What happened on that mission, and why was it significant enough for you to hold on to it?
Well, it's just one of the many missions in the Brenner Pass, and I don't exactly recall what mission that came from, but it was a close burst of anti-aircraft weapon, and it came down, took out part of my windshield, and hit part of my control column, and then down landed on the floor of my B-25, and I was able to salvage that.
Was that a frequent occurrence, something to crash through your windshield, or was that more rare? And did that get your attention a little bit when that happened?
Well, that was a one-time occurrence. That's about it. I had other types where flak went through part of the aircraft, but nothing real serious.
Well, and you talked about how reliable and durable those B-25s were, and obviously you're living proof of that. When something like that happens, when you see that shrapnel come right through the windshield and you make it home from that mission, do you stop and think, man, a few inches this way or that way, and I might not still be here? How did you deal with those realities?
You just live with it. That's all I can say about it.
Did you ever find yourself, when you did make it back home to your base after a mission, stopping taking a big sigh of relief, stepping back and reflecting on any of it, or did you just try to move on?
Just have to move on one day at a time. That's all you can do.
Were you ever afraid up there? Were you scared that each mission might be your last?
Never had the time to think about that part of it.
Give us a sense, if you can, of your relationship with your crew members. What kind of guys were they? Did you spend a lot of time together when you weren't on a B-25?
No, most of the time they had their quarters and we had our own. We were separated, but they were a real fine, good group of fellas, and we got along very, very well.
I want to try to understand what it was like for you to fly so many missions bombing the enemy in this war that you didn't know when it was going to end. You didn't know that there was a date at the end of it. Was that hard for you, the uncertainty of it all, not knowing how long this is going to last?
Well, yeah, because when I first joined the squadron, a normal tour of duty was 35 missions. And then I got about halfway, and the group commander, the General Knapp, ran it up to 50 missions. And I got halfway on that, and he ran it up to 70. And that was the uncertain part of it, when it would all end.
Absolutely. Well, we do know when this program will end, 2 o'clock, so we better catch our first break here. 90-year-old Richard Emler of Fresno, our guest today. We'll hear about some of those 70 missions as a B-25 bomber pilot when we come back. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ. After a down-to-the-wire Bulldog game, there's nothing quite like throwing yourself onto a comfortable bed. Paul Leffler here. You know, I heard my buddy Ray Ocanto talking about his mattress on the radio, and I thought, wait just a second. Wait till I tell you about the one my wife and I found at Sleep Retreat. Sleep Retreat is Fresno's only premium bedding store on El Paso, right next to Fashion Furniture. I heard Ray use the word comfort, but I can't imagine any bed being more comfortable than the Tempur-Pedic Cloud Lux we're sleeping on. It's soft where you want it to be soft, firm where you want it to be firm, and if you really want the long and short of it, it doesn't matter if your legs are long or short. My wife Tanya's about 5'1 and petite. I'm 6'3 and not so petite. But that oh-so-comfortable Tempur-Pedic mattress fits us both like a glove. I guess I should have seen it coming. After all, Tempur-Pedic invented memory foam. Tempur-Pedic is the most recommended sleep surface in America. And nobody in Central California knows Tempur-Pedic better than the fine folks at Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 90-year-old Richard Emler, originally from San Jose. He's been in Fresno for the last 65 years now. If you were around him in the Air Force Reserve when he retired, maybe you called him Lieutenant Colonel Emler. But if you dealt with him in the insurance business, I bet you probably just knew him as Dick. We've heard about how he became a B-25 pilot, including those late nights hiding out in bathroom stalls after lights out so he could study for a difficult math course. That was at Maxwell Field in Montgomery, Alabama, where the commanding general had greeted them with a promise it would be second in discipline only to West Point. That turned out to be the truth. Dick says that made a big difference in his life. He wouldn't be here talking to us today without surviving 70 missions with the 445th Squadron of the 321st Bomb Group. We're going to talk about some of those missions, including the one that earned him the Distinguished Flying Cross. But let's find out first about that unique aircraft he flew, a twin-engine medium bomber.
What was it like to fly a B-25? Did it take a lot of physical strength? Did it take a lot of focus? What can you tell us about that?
Well, it didn't take a lot of strength, but you had to keep your wits about you and remember what you were doing. I know the B-25 was fairly maneuverable, especially in the G and the H model. It had the cannon, the 75-millimeter cannon in it. So it could go in at a low level and turn. and even bank at 90 degrees, so it was pretty maneuverable.
What would you say was the riskiest maneuver you made with it, or a trick that you tried with it that you actually got away with?
I didn't try any tricks. I just figured I better fly it the way it's supposed to be flown, and everybody would survive.
Had you heard stories of B-25s going down in training or in other missions where they tried to do too much with it?
No, none that I heard of. I know one of our groups did a barrel roll with the 25, and that pretty well wiped out the 25 and went to the junk heap. It wasn't built. It wasn't stressed for that sort of thing.
How cold was it in that airplane on these bombing missions?
Well, in the wintertime in Brenner Pass, it was down zero and below, and we didn't have any heated uniforms. We didn't have any auxiliary oxygen, so we just had to do the best we had with our clothing. Consisted of our hands a silk liner for a glove, and then a wool glove, then a leather glove, and that was the best we could do. And that's why I have borderline frostbite on my hands and my feet.
And that's something that you've lived with now for all these years. What has that been like? Is that a burden that you carry? Does that bother you that you've had numbness or borderline frostbite, as you put it? Or are you okay with that?
Oh, I managed to get by. It's a fact of life, and I just live with it. It's that simple.
And that's an attitude I've heard reflected by most of the veterans I talk to. But there's a reality there that we don't talk about a lot, or certainly wasn't talked about then. So many guys came back, and there were lingering effects of the war, flashbacks at night, nightmares. Did you ever experience any of that? And if so, how did you deal with it?
I don't recall. Some of that stuff I prefer to forget, and that's it.
Fair enough. Well, you told us how cold it was in the B-25. What about where you were stationed there in Corsica? How cold did it get there?
In December of 1944, we had snow on the ground, about 6 inches of snow, and we lived in 16 by 16 pyramidal tent, but we had the heater rigged up so we could burn gas, aviation gasoline in the heater, so we kept warm inside, and that was about it.
Would Uncle Sam have been upset if he found out about that?
Probably would, but a lot of us did it, so there's nothing he could do about it.
I imagine there are a lot of things like that, that you guys just used your ingenuity to find solutions to problems. Any other thing come to mind like that? Some unorthodox ways that you guys went about living?
Oh, not offhand, no. Just good old Yankee ingenuity. That's all it was to it.
The people there in the surrounding area, the native inhabitants there of Corsica, whose freedom you're fighting for, as well as so many other people's, what did you see there? What did you observe, and how did they treat you?
Well, we really didn't have much contact with the natives. About the only time I saw them was after every one of our meals, there'd be a group would walk down towards the mess hall and pick up what scraps we had left over, and that was about it.
And to see that, to see people that were so desperate, did that do something to you? Did that remind you of why you were doing what you were doing?
Well, I suppose it did at the time, but I can't recall. But it sure impressed me that you don't want to waste anything.
Now, you talk about, you know, them continually raising the bar in terms of how many missions you have to fly before you can come home. Are you one of those who always believed you would come home?
Oh, yeah, I figured I'd make it, but who knows? We don't know until we get back.
And where does that come from? What made you believe that you would make it back? Because I think a lot of people say, hey, 70 missions, anti-aircraft fire just about every time, going back to where you know the enemy guns are waiting for you, they wouldn't put your odds very good. What made you believe? Where did that come from, this belief that you would survive?
I just had my head made up that's the way it's going to be, and if they caught me when I was asleep, so to speak, I'd be a dead duck.
What was so special about November 1st, 1944?
Oh, that's the date that I became a so-called aircraft commander, and that was about 6 weeks before I turned 22 years of age.
That's a lot of responsibility for a 21-year-old.
Absolutely it is. But I survived, thank heaven for that.
A lot of the bomber guys that I've talked to, some of them never had a chance to get in on any of this, but other guys did have the chance to name an aircraft or add a little nose art to one of their bombers. Did you ever have that privilege?
No, I didn't. My aircraft was already named when I got it.
And why do I have the sense you weren't completely fond of the name it had?
I was really very happy with it.
Yeah, what was it?
Want me to tell you?
Yeah.
House Mouse. A green outhouse with a half moon on the door and a black mouse down on the front of it.
Did that give you guys a little comic relief?
Oh, I imagine it did.
And speaking of comic relief, now, you were bombing quite frequently. 70 missions is a lot, but I'm sure you had a little downtime, too. What's this your daughter tells me about the Rum Runners? What's that story?
Oh, once in a while, if we were lucky, we got an R&R. And one R&R I made with some other crew members down to Cairo, Egypt, then over to Tel Aviv, which at that time was Palestine. It was a British protectorate. We brought back $5,000 worth of booze for the squadron.
Must have been a pretty big party.
That had to last for a while.
What other kinds of things did you guys do to pass the time when you weren't assigned on a mission?
Read books and just kind of rolled around, did nothing.
Did you ever get letters from home?
Oh, yeah. Well, once in a while, I had a mail call, and we sent letters back. It was just a daily occurrence. But you didn't always get mail, so you did the best you could with what you had.
Let me step over here and read your Distinguished Flying Cross citation, and then I'll ask you about that here. So this is dated 26 April 1945. The Distinguished Flying Cross is awarded to Richard S. Emler, 1st Lieutenant Air Corps, 321st Bombardment Group, for extraordinary achievement while participating in serial flight as pilot of a B-25 type aircraft. On 18 February 1945, Lieutenant Emler flew in an attack upon a railroad bridge at Lavis, Italy, courageously maintaining his plane in formation in the face of intense anti-aircraft fire for a second run over the objective. When an overcast prevented bombing on the first run, Lieutenant Emler enabled his bombardier to release his bombs with devastating effect upon this vital objective. On more than 60 combat missions, his outstanding proficiency and steadfast devotion to duty have reflected great credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States. Signed, of course, by a major general then in April of 1945. That's a pretty prestigious medal that you have there. When you just heard me read those words that were written so many years ago, what did it bring to mind for you? What does that mean to you today?
It just means that I survived one more mission, and I'm grateful for that.
Reading between the lines there, I want to get the story from you. You're bombing a railroad bridge, but there's overcast. So when you come through, and I think it's important to note, you know you're going to get shot with this anti-aircraft fire. You make this first run. What happened? Why couldn't you guys get the bombs off?
Probably due to the weather condition prevented that. And fortunately, we made a circle around and came back and found a hole in the cloud bank, and we dropped, and that was it.
But I imagine if you've already flown through this flak, and again, we've discussed this many times on the program with quite a few bomber pilots, when you're flying in formation toward a bomb target, you can't dodge the flak. You've got to fly straight through it, right?
That's right. That's the way it goes. I just hope you come out all right.
So when you've already flown this very same bomb run and experienced the flak, the last thing you want to do is go do it again, right?
You don't have much choice. You just do it, and that's it.
And am I imagining correctly that when that happens, that it probably dials up the tension just a little bit among that six-man crew?
Oh, I suppose it does. Everybody has a bit of a nervous condition.
And how thick was that fire on that mission? Obviously, they thought highly enough of it to give you the DFC for performing that bomb run. What do you remember about how intense and imposing it was?
Well, I think that's one where we had a few holes in the fuselage and in the wings. You can hear the shrapnel bite through the metal skin of the aircraft, but you just hope it doesn't have your name on it.
Did you ever have any of the guys on your crew suffer wounds from that anti-aircraft fire?
Only one in October 1944, but just a leg wound, so that wasn't too bad.
And were you guys in the habit, when you got back from a mission, of taking stock of how many holes were in the plane? Did you count them up?
If we got hit, yeah, we always did that. We're grateful that we survived, and that's all.
And I'll use a euphemism here of the outhouse mouse, we'll call it. Did you fly most of those missions in that aircraft?
Yes, most of them. The first 12 missions, I was a co-pilot, and after that, it was my airplane. So I had a total of 58 missions in the B-25.
So you and that plane had a pretty good relationship.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And they're excellent crew chief and assistant crew chief.
When did you find out that they were giving you the Distinguished Flying Cross? Did someone come and pin on it, or to show up in the mail? Or?
No, there was a General Knapp called everybody up to squadron formation, and he was the one that pinned the medal on me.
In front of all your friends?
Oh, yeah, the whole squadron was out there.
What did that feel like? What did that mean to you?
I really don't recall. I'm sorry about that.
I imagine it must have made you feel like you did a good job.
I did a good job on every mission, and I knew I was going to survive as long as I did a good job.
70 missions. I've asked you a few scattered details about some of them. I know anti-aircraft fire was an issue. Did you ever go head-to-head with German fighter planes at all?
No, they didn't have enough fuel to put any fighter planes. Early on, let's see, in the late 45, 44, we had a few, but I never had any encounters with German aircraft.
What stands out in your mind as your closest calls, the times that got your attention or took your breath away the most?
Most of them were enough to get my attention when the aircraft, anti-aircraft was in the vicinity. That could get your attention in a hurry.
I can only imagine, having not felt it, but speaking of feeling it, when you know you're on this bomb run, you're trying to get the bombardier in position to drop those bombs, and the flak is coming, are you bracing? Are you gritting your teeth? Are you closing your eyes? Give us a sense of what it's like to be in control, or at least be at the controls of that B-25 in that situation.
Well, for the most part, I was lucky enough to fly in the number 2 position, which is on the right wing of the leader. My attention was on the lead ship to make sure we didn't crash. I wasn't able to see much other than just that lead aircraft.
Did you ever have a situation where your plane was damaged to the point that it wasn't working the way it was supposed to?
No, never. Never, never, never.
Never lost an engine or anything?
No.
Boy, that was one solid mouse you were flying then.
Absolutely, best in the West.
Do you ever wonder what happened to that airplane?
Well, I know. It went to the scrap heap like a lot of them, which is unfortunate, but that's the way it goes.
If you see a B-25 now, for instance, you can go up the road to Atwater and Castle Air Museum has a B-25 on display there. If you walk up to a B-25, what's that experience like for you now? What kind of thoughts go through your head?
Well, just grateful for the fact that I was able to survive.
Well, we are grateful for that, too. Time to take another break. If you want to see some photos of Mr. Emler and his B-25, which we're going to sanitize to Outhouse Mouse, go to our website, kmjnow.com, or check out the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. It's good to get to know so many of you there. We'll be back with the rest of Mr. Emler's story after this. It's Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of 2. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Continuing now with 90-year-old Richard Emler of Fresno, California. You'll find some great photos of him then and now on our website at kmjnow.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. He's told us about some of the close calls he experienced flying 70 missions as a B-25 pilot with the 321st Bomb Group, and we have more to explore. You were able to survive, and with a lot of other guys from your bomb group, you ended up going to Washington, D.C. for a reunion, and there's a picture here of you right in front of the White House. You got to meet President George W. Bush. What was that like?
Well, I can't recall what it was like. It's just another part of our reunion.
And I imagine that it made you feel like you did something worthwhile if the President of the United States is going to welcome you and honor you that way. And that photo has your name on it. It has his signature on it.
And I shook hands with the President. I was one of the few that was able to do that. So that was a highlight of the reunion.
When you think about it now, you know, you've had children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, people who would have never been born if you didn't survive all 70 of those missions. What does that make you think of? How do you explain that you came home?
There's just no explanation for it. That's my destiny, I guess.
So when the war was winding down in Europe, and again, you didn't know when the war was going to end, when did you figure that out? When did you get a sense, you know what, this might be over pretty soon?
That was on the day it happened. We found out through the Armed Forces radio system that the Germans had finally surrendered.
Was that greeted with celebration? What was the reaction where you were?
Well, we had quite a celebration, yeah.
When you think of your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids and people like me who didn't live in this time in our history when things were so different and when America was so united and so many people served, 16 million Americans in the armed forces, more than 400,000 Americans killed in World War II, what do you think we need to understand today about what all you guys did way back then?
Well, I really don't. I never give it much thought. I'm just grateful that everybody's alive, and so far we're a free nation. The only thing I can say is that those who have not served or been stuck with the war are extremely fortunate, because it does leave, there's some after effects that are slow but sure recede, but they linger for a long time.
Even today?
Oh yeah, every once in a while there's a thought here and there, and that's all I can say about it.
And you're not looking for sympathy or attention. You're not bragging. You're not complaining. But the damage to your extremities from the severe cold that you dealt with, how has that impacted your life? What have you had to deal with? Just try to help us understand the everyday lingering effect of that you've dealt with all these years.
It's just one of those things I put up with day to day. And in wintertime, I just bundle up a little bit more than I normally would, and that's about it.
Does it affect your sense of feeling, your sense of touch? Can you not feel things that maybe you would have beforehand?
Oh, once in a while, yeah, and they get to the point that I have to stop and get them somehow warmed up so I can feel the way they should be.
But you're pretty used to it by now.
Oh, yeah, I've lived with it for a long, long time.
I guess it was, what, about a year ago or so, maybe a little longer, that someone stole some of your medals and that piece of shrapnel that had come into your B-25 cockpit. Did that make you angry when that happened? What did that do to you?
Yeah, I wish I'd been able to catch the guys that did it, because I think I would have put a lot of hurt on them.
I don't doubt it. I believe you. Would it be important for you to get those medals back?
Up to a certain point, yeah, but mostly for to pass them on to my kids and grandkids.
Did you ever lose any of your buddies overseas?
Oh, yes. In fact, I lost one of my tent mates. Went down into Brenner Pass in February 1945. In fact, I was on the right wing when it got shot down.
By anti-aircraft fire?
Yes. We got a direct hit in the right engine.
So what did you see? What did it look like to you?
It was very, very upsetting. There were two of them that got killed. One of them was my tent mate, Lucian Crutchfield, and the other was Harris in the Bombardier Navigator. And some of them managed to get picked up by the partisans, and the pilot, J.E. DeBoer, walked through the snow into Switzerland, and that's about it.
So when you saw that, and I don't want to bring up painful things for you and dwell on it too much, but I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. It's hard for you to see that happen to a friend of yours, a guy that you've spent all this time with, and then doesn't it have to make you wonder about your own situation too?
Well, I don't think I really had time to wonder about my situation, just about wonder, hopefully they'd survive.
You know, I call this program Hometown Heroes, and a lot of guys have a problem with that. They bristle at that because most guys your age who fought in the war don't want to be called heroes. You felt like you were just doing your job, and I've certainly heard that from you in this interview. But to us younger folks, it's heroic that you were willing to put your lives on the line for our country. I imagine you think of people like the friend you just described as the real heroes of World War II. Is that how you feel, or if not, set me straight?
Well, I suppose that's about it. The people that survived really weren't heroes. It's the ones that didn't survive that were the heroes.
I'm sure there are a lot of images in your mind from the war, and I'm interested in hearing some of those. I see one right here, a photo of this B-25, and it's got your name painted on the side. It's got you and your crew standing in front of it. And you told us about the mouse, but I see about 100 little mice painted underneath there. What does each one of those mice signify?
Each mouse signified a mission. And I think that photo was when the when that particular aircraft came back from 100 missions without an early return due to mechanical failure. It was quite a day.
Yeah, you got quite the special airplane there, because not many could claim that kind of record. There's another photo here of you on a camel in front of the Great Pyramids and the Sphinx.
Cairo, Egypt, in February of 1945, immediately following the loss of J.D. Boren and the death of my tent mate, Lucian Crutchfield. I was sent on a 10-day R&R, and that was part of our trip onto Tel Aviv, where we picked up our booze for the squadron. We were going on a 10-day trip.
And what was that like for the guy who, a year earlier or so, a couple years earlier, was riding motorcycles around San Jose and Highway 17 down to Santa Cruz, to be standing there in front of these Great Pyramids and the Sphinx? That had to be quite the experience for you.
Oh, yeah, it was quite an eye-opener. And as I look back, it's part of my life that I thought, had it not been for the war, I would never have seen it.
What's bumpier, flying a B-25 or riding a camel?
Camel is pretty easy. Pretty good easy gait.
They're notorious for spitting. Did that ever happen to you?
No, never did. I never got in front of them.
Smart man. I'm pretty sure you didn't have camels to ride growing up in San Jose, right?
Oh, no. Didn't even know what they were.
I know you've been to reunions and you've gotten back in the cockpit of a B-25. If there is one airplane that you could go out and fly right now, which one would it be and why?
Oh, I'm going to go back in the B-25 because I remember the power settings, so that's no problem.
You know you could at least get off the ground in that one, huh?
Absolutely. I remember where all the controls were, for the flaps and the landing gear, and so that's it.
I mentioned images from the war. What are some of the visuals that stand out in your mind, the things that you saw that you never would have seen had you not been where you were?
Well, I'm sure that had it not been for the war, I probably have never gone too far from San Jose, California. I wouldn't have gone to halfway around the world or probably a good part of the United States.
Are you proud to be a World War II veteran?
Oh, absolutely. I'm proud of everything I did. I just went in and did my job, and that was about it. I didn't look for anything special.
What is it that keeps you going?
Destiny, I guess.
Don't have some secret you can share with all the rest of us?
Just keep breathing.
Yeah, don't stop. Well, Mr. Emler, on behalf of all our listeners, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a little bit about those 70 missions. I don't know if that stolen piece of shrapnel can be recovered, but our local congressmen are pretty good at getting veterans the medals they deserve, so we're going to work on getting those replaced. For you at home, I bet you've picked up on the reluctance to draw attention to himself. It's not the first time you've heard that kind of perspective on Hometown Heroes, but I'm going to throw you a little curveball here. One thing that really impressed me about Mr. Emler and his family is how his two daughters, Denise and Penny, revere him so sincerely. They've been to reunions with him. The photos you'll find online were all provided by Denise. I'm sure she's listening down in Bakersfield, so thanks, Denise. And Penny is with him in Fresno. I thought since we couldn't get him to talk all that much about his exploits, maybe we could get Penny to brag on him just a little bit. Penny, what is it about your dad and his service in World War II that makes you beam with pride when you think about it?
Dad has always been someone who was consistently there for you. If he said he was going to do something, he did it, unless there was a serious reason that he couldn't, like, you know, broke your arm or something. He's never been real demonstrative, but had I been over there with him, now knowing him, you just feel safe when he's around because you know he's there. He's highly intelligent. He's extremely funny when you can get him to tell stories. But as you've discovered, he doesn't talk about himself much. He is very quiet. He's not a braggart. He's very self-assuming. But he is a really cool guy. And as you've discovered by looking at him and visiting with him, you would not have guessed he's 90. There is no way. He still drives. He gets around great. Sharp as a tack. And between he and my mom, they gave my sister and I a whole lot in growing up. A lot of the kindness and the people that we are is because they showed it. Dad doesn't talk a big program. He just does the program.
When did you realize that he had done something in World War II that was pretty special, that wasn't just a ho-hum deal here?
Oh, my word. It was like, I was in my 30s before some of the stories finally started trickling out. I mean, we saw the medals when we were little. It's like you're always digging around in the McGee closet and pulling in photo albums and, you know, oh, cool, what's in this box, Dad? I mean, so you kind of heard the stories, but you only heard like a little thumbnail sketch. Oh, yeah, that's when I was overseas. Okay. But then as we got older, and we got to know some of the people he was with, then you started hearing more and more of the stories. And yeah, it was pretty impressive. It was pretty impressive. He worked extremely hard to do what he looked at was, okay, this is my job.
He didn't share a whole lot of emotion with me, but I'm wondering for you, when you read that citation for the Distinguished Flying Cross, or you think about that piece of shrapnel that he brought home, and you realize that he survived 70 missions with a bunch of heavy German guns shooting at him every time. And if he didn't, you wouldn't be here. When you think about that, what does it do to you?
I guess my sister and I and the kids were just really, really thrilled that we've been able to keep him all this time. Dad never talked about the scary aspect of it. It's like it's shut away, it's gone. Once in a while, there'll be something on TV or at one of the reunions or something, somebody will say something and it'll trigger something and you'll see a little glint, a tear in the eye, and everybody's quiet for a minute. But they don't dwell on the ugly stuff, on the scary stuff, on the any of that. They just don't, which is way unlike people today. People today whine and cry. It's like, you know, my car got stolen. Okay, get over it. Get on the bus and go to work. You know, bad things happen, and bad things happen to good people and bad people. And Dad's generation, they don't dwell on that. He's very unemotional about a whole lot of stuff, but he's solid as a rock. I mean, he's just always there. And so, yeah, he went through a whole lot more than maybe a lot of other people did. Because you saw all the things on the side of the plane. I mean, the places that they were stationed were some of the worst in the war. And am I grateful? Oh, you bet I am. Am I grateful we still have him today at 90? Oh, absolutely. He's just a really awesome person.
Says it all to me. Is there anything else you think we ought to know about him?
I wish you all had a chance to just come and visit, spend an afternoon with him, because he's an awesome person.
Well, we all got to spend a part of our afternoon with him, and your perspective has given us an even clearer picture. Thanks, Penny. That's Penny Crawford about her dad, Richard Emler. I'll tell you, he's an impressive guy today, and I think you'll get an even clearer idea of the guy he was in World War II flying those B-25s if you check out the photos there online. Quite a few of them on Facebook if you go to the Hometown Heroes page. And also at our website, kmjnow.com. If you find the Hometown Heroes blog there, you can listen to all our past programs on the website as well. Next week's show should be fun. We're going to hear from Bob Hope and Bing Crosby. You'll understand when next Saturday rolls around. It's a chance for you to take a trip back in time and also support the Central California Veterans Home, a great cause at the same time. I'll look forward to telling you all about it. Remember to thank the veterans in your life for their service to our country. And please join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.